This being Forrest Long, where Yogananda's body is buried, I thought I would begin by reading the last chapter from my book, The New Path. Sir, I said to Master one day, after you are gone, will you be as near to us as you are now? To those who think me near, he replied, I will be near. It will be very soon, I feel, Dayamata remarked to me one day in her office. But surely, I protested, Master will return once more, first to India. He had been planning to go and was planning to go again that year, and had mentioned to me how sad the Indian disciples were, that he had missed going these last 2 years. Do you think so? Gazing at me calmly, Daya said no more. Her presentiment, however, proved correct. One day, Master visited an antique shop to purchase a few canes. In whatever he did, he assumed the consciousness appropriate to that activity. Now, therefore, since he was conducting business, he bargained carefully. Once the transaction was over, he ceased to play the role of conscientious buyer, saving money for his monastery. Gazing about him, he noticed marks of poverty in the shop. Sympathetically then, he gave the owner much more money than he saved by bargaining with him. You are a gentleman, sir, exclaimed the man, deeply touched. To show his appreciation, he gave Master a particularly fine antique umbrella. When Master returned home, he sighed, what a poor looking floor that man had in his shop. I think I'll buy him a new carpet. How perfectly he manifested in his life the truth that to the man of Christ consciousness, all men are brothers. The last issue of Self-Realization magazine to come out during Master's lifetime contained an article titled The Final Experience. It was the last in a series of Master's commentaries on the New Testament Gospels that had been running continuously for 20 years. In this issue, Master expanded on the words, and when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. Surely the perfect timeliness of this article was more than a coincidence. It appeared in the March 1952 issue. Master passed away on March 7, 1952. As a further interesting note, the writing of the first edition of the account in these pages about Master's passing coincided closely with the season of Christ's passing. The day before I wrote it was Good Friday, 1976. Several days before the end, another disciple posed Master a question similar to the one I had asked him 2 years earlier. Have all your disciples in this life come to you yet, sir? I am waiting for two or three more to come, Master replied. In that week, two more disciples arrived. At Leland Standing, later Brother Mokshananda, and Madame Erbatiso, a well-known and highly successful lawyer from Switzerland, who not long afterwards gave up her profession to organize centers for Master's work in Europe. There was, I believe, one other who came at this time, but I don't recall that person's name. We had been impressed by Leland's spirit from months of correspondence with him. Master had written him at last, suggesting that he come to live at Mount Washington. Leland met Master shortly after his arrival there. You have good spirit, Master told him. Remember, loyalty is the greatest thing. Master had been staying at his 29 Palms retreat. He returned to Mount Washington on March 2nd, to meet His Excellency Binay R. Sheng, India's recently appointed ambassador to the United States. On the evening of his return, he embraced each of us lovingly and blessed us. To some, he gave words of personal help, to others, encouragement to be stable in their spiritual efforts, to still others, the advice to meditate more. Afterwards, I got to see him briefly upstairs alone. Many times over the past 3.5 years, Master had scolded me, mostly for my slowness in understanding him perfectly, sometimes for not weighing in advance the possible consequences of my words. I knew that he often said I scold only those who listen, not those who don't. But in my heart there lingered a certain hurt. Try as I would, I couldn't rationalize it away. For some months I had been hungering for a few words of approval from him. Now, alone with me, he gazed into my eyes with deep love and understanding and said, "You have pleased me very much. I want you to know that." What a burden lifted from my heart at these few simple words. On Tuesday, March 4th, the ambassador and his party visited Mount Washington. I served Master and his guests in his upstairs interview room. During their visit, Mr. Ahuja, India's Consul General in San Francisco, remarked to Master, "Ambassadors may come and ambassadors may go, but you, Paramahamsaji, are India's real ambassador to America." Thursday evening, March 6th, Master returned from a ride in the car. He had asked Clifford Frederick, who was driving, to take him over Rome Drive behind Mount Washington. There, gazing at the main building, he remarked quietly, "It looks like a castle, doesn't it?" The monks had just finished their group practice of the energization exercises when Master's car entered the driveway. As we gathered around him, he touched each one of us in blessing, and then spoke at length about some of the delusions encountered on the spiritual path. "Don't waste your time," he said. "No one can give you the desire for God. That is something you must cultivate yourselves. Don't sleep a great deal. Sleep is the unconscious way of contacting God. Meditation is a state beyond sleep, superconsciousness as opposed to subconsciousness. Don't spend too much time joking. I myself like to laugh, but I keep my sense of humor fully under control. When I am serious, nobody can tempt me to laugh. Be happy within, grave but ever cheerful. Why waste your spiritual perceptions in useless words? When you have filled the bucket of your consciousness with the milk of peace, keep it that way. Don't drive holes in it by joking and idle speech. Don't waste time on distractions, reading all the time, and so on. If reading is instructive, of course, it is good. But I tell people, if you read 1 hour, then write 2 hours, think 3 hours, and meditate all the time. No matter how much this organization keeps me busy, I never forget my daily tryst with God." In the basement, minutes later, Master saw a box of green coconuts that had just arrived from A.B. George's brother, in Florida. Back at the car, Divine Mother was trying to tell me these coconuts had come, but I didn't listen. I was talking too much. Master, laughing genially, opened a coconut and drank from it. But his enjoyment seemed to me somehow tinged with unreality. I looked into his eyes and saw them deep, still, completely untouched by what he was doing. In retrospect, it seems like the heartiness of one who knew he was bidding us goodbye, but didn't want us to know that he was doing so. Catching my glance, he became all at once almost grave. "I have a big day tomorrow," he said. Walking toward the elevator, he paused at the door, then repeated, "I have a big day tomorrow. Wish me luck." The following day, March 7th, he came downstairs to go out. He was scheduled to attend a banquet that evening at the Biltmore Hotel in honor of the Indian ambassador. "Imagine," he said, "I've taken a room at the Biltmore, and that's where I first started in this city." Then again he repeated, "Wish me luck." Master had asked me to attend the banquet with Dick Ames, the popular singer and movie actor. Dick had recently become a disciple and had taken Kriya initiation from me. Years ago, Master had said, "When I leave this earth, I want to go speaking of my America and my India." And in a song about India that he had written to the tune of the popular song, My California, he paraphrased the original ending with the words, "I know when I die, in joy I will sigh for my sunny grand old India." Once, too, in a lecture, he had stated, "A heart attack is the easiest way to go. That is how I chose to die." This evening, all these predictions were to prove true. Master was scheduled to speak after the banquet. His brief talk was so sweet, so almost tender, that I think everyone present felt embraced in the gossamer net of his love. Warmly he spoke of India and America and of their respective contributions to world peace and true human progress. He talked of their future cooperation. Finally, he read his beautiful poem, My India. Throughout his speech, I was busy recording his words, keeping my eyes on my notebook. He came to the last line of the poem, where Ganges, woods, Himalayan caves, and men dream gone. I am hallowed, my body touched that sod. Sod became a long, drawn-out sigh. Suddenly, from all sides of the room, there came a loud cry. I looked up. "What is it?" I demanded of Dick Ames, seated beside me. "What happened?" "Master fainted," he replied. "Oh, no, Master. You wouldn't faint. You've left us. You've left us." The forgotten playwright in me cried silently, "This is too perfect a way for you to go, for it to mean anything else." I hastened to where Master lay. A look of bliss was on his face. Virginia Wright stooped over him, trying desperately to revive him. Mr. Ahuja, Consul General, came over to me and put an arm around my shoulder to comfort me. Never, dear friend, will I forget that sweet act of kindness. They brought Master's body to Mount Washington and placed it lovingly on his bed. One by one we went in, weeping, and knelt by his bedside. "Mother," cried Joseph, that's Bhimalananda, "oh, mother." "Indeed, Master's been a mother to us all. Ah, and how much more than a mother." Miss Lancaster gave me an anguished look. "How many thousands of years it took," marveled Laurie Pratt, gazing upon him in quiet awe, "to produce such a perfect face." Later on, after we'd left the room, Faye remained alone with Master's body. As she gazed at him, a tear formed on his left eyelid and slowly trickled down his cheek. Lovingly she caught it with her handkerchief. She would always preserve it. In death as in life, he was telling his beloved disciple, and through her the rest of us, "I love you always, through endless cycles of time, unconditionally, without any desire except for your happiness forever in God." What a wonderful ending. And how blessed I was to be there. But my life has not been lived to tell you how blessed I was. It is lived to tell you how blessed you are and can be, because whatever we receive from him is still available. And really, all of you, Master said, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. I won't call you sinners, but I will call you saints. All of you have that potential, and you're very close. Don't think you're far away. God is just behind the darkness of closed eyes. He's just behind your nearest thoughts. He is watching you, and all he wants is for you to watch him. All he wants is for you to think more of him, more about him, and to share your thoughts with him. Meditation is very good and a wonderful practice, but we should carry our meditation. Forgive me if I sit. I know you can't see me as easily from the back, but honestly, I find it a lot easier to sit. One advice I have to everybody is don't get old. The thing is that we are all that. We have that. We've been born for that. Master used to tell us it's very difficult to reach a human birth. And don't waste this opportunity. Of course, you've been in this human body probably for a long time. But you know, the appalling thing is you can fall from this thing. You can fall from the human level. It doesn't happen very often. It's not usual. Once you've reached the human level, usually people stay there. But if you act like an animal, you will become an animal. And if you do, you'll go down for one life only, and then you'll come back and be a human being again. So it's not as if you were likely to be a toad if you die now and don't find God, or a spider or something. I don't mean it that way. But I do mean that it's also a very serious thing when you've understood the need for seeking truth and the need for seeking God. Don't waste that opportunity. You know how far you can fall if you do continue to go? He said it's only for one life, but if you keep on erring and erring, you can go back for more than one life. And you can even sink as low as the level of a germ. Just think of it. It's horrifying to think. The suffering of the soul that knows where knows it should be more than it is, but can't be. It's got this limited body and has to evolve gradually up to the human level. This is a huge universe, the vast panorama. It's almost frightening when you think of it. I have to say that before I met Master, before I found his book, before I knew these things, I looked at people. I knew when I was 9 years old, I had a serious illness, and I was in my delirium. My dad first had read me Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, and Huckleberry Finn's father was a drunkard, and in my delirium at night, I would toss back and forth saying, I don't want to be a drunkard, I don't want to be a drunkard. But you know, when I came to think seriously about it, I realized I could be anything that any human being has been. I could be a drunkard, I could be a murderer, I could be a thief, I could be anything. Because whatever human beings are, they're doing on behalf of the human race, and they show our potential for depravity or for sanctity. So I urge you to take this life very seriously, because you never know what will come out in your karma. It's not likely, but it's possible. But why waste that time? Seek God. We were born to know Him. And sooner or later, there's no other opportunity, we have no option. You know, the wonderful thing about delusion is that it never keeps its promises. It always breaks them. So you think, oh, I'm going to finally make it. You don't. Something always happens to make it not quite right. Then you think, well, maybe next time I'll do that, and then it'll be right. It's not. Then try, maybe I'll tweak it this way. No, it's not. And one lifetime, although it seems like a long time while you're living it, once it's gone, it's just like that. Death is not something to be afraid of, but it's something certain. And so we should work hard to, when we reach that point, to reach it with a sense of freedom. Death is not painful. There is no pain in death. There may be pain before death in the body. There may be the mental pain of attachment. But I would say, remember that life is a preparation for that final exam. And many people, when they die, they see relatives. And it says in the Bhagavad Gita that when you die, that's the determining point, is your final exam, as I put it. is the determining point whether you go here or there. And I'm not talking either up or down. There's so many levels in the astral world, and that is the much more real world than this world. But in that world, you usually will go to your own relatives and friends, and you will always go to whatever level you are on. But many people at death have seen their grandmothers. Many times they have seen people who they didn't know had passed, and others in the room didn't know they had passed. But they said, "Oh, I see him there. What's he doing there in heaven?" And they find out later that he had already died, and he was there to welcome them. Their life is it's all a dream. Everything's a dream. But those, Krishna says, who worship their ancestors, that means your family, they go to the ancestors. Those who worship the lower gods go to their gods. Those who worship me come to me. And when you die and when you leave your body, you don't die, but your body dies. You know, when Master was in the trip here, Louis Royston, one of his disciples, was there with a group of nuns, and that they were all lamenting by his crypt here, which many of you will go to. And she suddenly felt Master right beside her, and he heard him say, "I'm not in there." But you know, many people I have read about have actually said the same thing, that those people that they were lamenting their death, those same people, they heard them say, "I'm not in there." And when you die, the chances are that you will come to your own funeral. People have said that she'll be late for her own funeral. Many people, when they die, they're at their funeral. When my mother died, I felt she was there. And then after a certain point, I felt she had left. She felt that she had received our love and she was free to go. But if we remember God at that last moment, even at the last moment you can attain Him. I remember one member of the church in Hollywood. He was a wonderful man, a black man. And when he died, his wife was very upset. He said, "Dear, don't worry. I just see life all around. Try to make your life such that when you die, you'll be happy. Others may cry, but you won't cry. Just as when you were born, you cry and everybody laughs." But this world is a very temporary thing. It just lasts a few seconds. And when you have your life review at the end of life, it just is very, very quick. But suddenly you realize and remember everything. Somebody told me, Brother Dharmananda, as Arif told me, he had been almost drowning, and he started to go down for the third time, and then somehow he was saved. I forget whether somebody pulled him out or he was able to hang onto a branch and came back. But he said that he saw his whole life review, and he said certain things I had thought were not important were very important, and some things that I had thought were important were not important at all. And that his whole sense of values changed from that moment, and he became a disciple of Master after that. He came after Master's lifetime. You know, another point that is very important to keep in mind, Master said he was the last of the gurus. But he also told me personally that you have to meet your guru one time in the flesh, at least one time. Now, what about you poor slobs? Were you out of luck? No, it's like a race with a baton. He is still like Jesus Christ was the, you know, when you have an avatar, he comes in this world with a power that is much, much greater than an ordinary saint. He comes with great divine power, as it said, as Lahiri Mahashaya said to Mother, Master's mother when she carried him as a baby in her arms to get Lahiri Mahashaya's blessing. He said that your son will be a yogi, and as a spiritual engine, he will bring many souls to God's shore. And I remember seeing freight trains miles long. He can carry all of you there. But what about that thing of personal contact? That's a very important thing too. And don't think you can get it just by going straight to him. You do have to come through the disciples. It's a baton that is passed. My role, however, is not to take you to me, is to help you to understand and to feel the power that he is transmitting to you. This is my only purpose and my only blessing, and to me it is a very great blessing. I don't count in the picture, except sort of as a window. I said to Anandamoyi Ma, whom I loved very much in India, you know, with Master, I have to say that I was always, although I loved him deeply, I was always just slightly in awe of him. I could never overcome that feeling of, God, what greatness. But with her, it was sort of like my own mother. And I remember one time saying to her that you're just, to me, like a window through which the divine light is shining. And she jokingly said, well, I've been called many things before, but not a window. But I'm sure she knew what I meant. Because that is what the truth is. And I'm only trying, in my humble best and whatever capacity he gives me and allows me to have, I try to help to share with you that. But that real power comes from him. And without that, I would be just the jerk that I was before I met him. Not that I was really a jerk. I was actually seeking quite seriously and very, very intensely. But anyway, I was nothing. What is any human being except a little tiny reflection of God? You know, this is a wonderful thing that Master said, that we are all like little bits of glass in the sunshine. And when the sun shines upon that glass, it shines. But when there's no sun there, the glass doesn't shine. So we don't shine of our own power. We shine because that light is shining on us and reflecting it. Remember that. There is a very impersonal side to all of this. And I think that one of the things that in this new monastic order that I'm trying to create, the idea of ego, back in the days of Shankara, people, it was very difficult to understand that we are not this ego. But now we can see, because science has shown us a universe that where this physical universe doesn't exist except it's a vibration of energy. Everything is just energy. And many scientists have also said that beyond energy, it seems as if there may be thoughts and consciousness behind that energy, and that energy itself is only a manifestation of thought. Well, this is the truth of it. God didn't create anything the way. He had nothing to create it out of. He could only create it out of his own consciousness. He had to dream us into existence. And we are dreaming, but the thing is, it's his dream, not ours, and so we can't change it so easily. But we don't exist as egos. We are, every one of us is the little, all our consciousness and everything we know is a reflection of that infinite consciousness. And this teaching can be told now. And so what I want to emphasize to people more than could ever have done, been done before, is to get rid of this thought that I am I. You have nothing to defend. You have nothing to push. Here in Hollywood, there's a lot of self-promotion. I would like to change it to self with a large S, promoting the God in you. Because what can you do that is of any importance in the general scheme of things? You strut your piece on the stage, as Shakespeare put it, and then are heard no more. But that little bit that you can gain spiritually, that is your treasure forever. You can't take your home with you, you can't take your bank account with you, you can't even take your friends with you, although you do in the sense that you meet them again and again. But the one thing you cannot leave behind you is your own self. You're stuck with yourself. Where however long you go, you can't get away from it. I remember I had come back from Mexico, where I had thought to sort of find freedom there from all the conventions of Scarsdale and American middle class and so on. And I was with a group of people at college at Brown University, and we were talking about the razor's edge. And this girl said, if only I could go to India and just get lost. Well, I laughed because I had just come back from trying to lose myself. And I said, whom would you lose? You wouldn't lose yourself. That's the one thing you can't get away from. So why not make friends with yourself? If you analyze yourself, you'll see that there are certain things that do make you happy. And there are certain things that you do that don't make you happy. Why not take that lesson? You know, one of the great advantages of living together in community is that people together, you can see those who live the right life, those who live by spiritual principles, they always are happy. And those who think, what's in it for me, and what can I do, and what's my position, and worry about themselves, they're never happy. And you see this over 40 years as we've been there. You can see object lessons all around you. You don't have to go through every lesson yourself. You can learn it by example. But everything that you can see also in your own life, if you are kind to somebody, you feel better. I would say that more than love, I would emphasize respect. Because respect, in love there can be a certain amount of attachment. If it's impersonal love, fine. Impersonal love means that you want nothing from other people. It includes wanting to give completely to other people of yourself. But there is no demand in return. That's what I mean by personal love. But it's difficult in human love not to have something that you want back. But in respect, there isn't any of that. So I would say, first of all, learn to respect everybody. And I was struck by Master, who was the greatest man I have ever met. And yet he showed such humble respect for everybody. And the various doorman or waiter or anybody, he just treated everybody as a very special person. And it was a wonderful lesson to me. And I would say, try to develop that. See God in everybody and respect God in everybody. Then the next thing to do instead of love is bliss. The goal of life is Satchidananda. Ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. Seek that bliss above all, because it's in that bliss that impersonal love comes. When you have impersonal love, then you love everybody. And you go down the streets and see people and you just can't help loving them. And why? Because you know they're all looking for that same bliss. There's nothing you want back from them. You don't care what they think of you. Rather, it's wonderful that if people talk against you and mock you and everything. I remember I was at a big function in Virginia where, I forget his name now, he's a well-known speaker in America, and he was wanting to start a community. And he invited many prominent people and speakers, and I was one of them. And to speak at this event in which he would announce this community. Well, I was the only person among all those speakers who had actually started a community and made a success of it. And I invited a group of these people out to dinner. Well, I don't like to push myself, and I was perfectly happy, but I was struck by the fact that because I'm not that much on the lecture circuit, I don't go all around teaching all the time, I don't care to. But so these people were talking to these more famous people to each other and virtually ignoring me who was paying the bill. I felt how absolutely wonderful to be completely unimportant. It was a wonderful feeling. I remember at a function and there was a young woman I was talking to afterwards outside, and I asked her name after a while, and she told me, I forget what it was. And she said, "What is your name?" And I said, "Swami Kriyananda." "Swami Kriyananda, but you're famous." I said, "Well, fine, but why do you say but?" She said, "Well, all the other famous people I know seem important." I knew she meant self-important, but I was absolutely delighted at this thought of not being important. We just are not, we don't matter in this world. He's the only one who does everything, and he gives us this delusion that we're doing it, but it's a delusion. The more you give the credit to him, I remember once in the Hollywood church, somebody complimented me on a talk, and I said, "Well, God is the doer." She said, "Really?" As if I knew it was good, I didn't know it was that good. That's not what I meant. I meant that God does everything, good, bad, indifferent. He's the dreamer. And try to dream with him. Try to do those things. It's for your own sake. There's room for selfishness. This is divine selfishness. Do those things which will make you happy. You're much happier giving to people than taking from them. That's divine selfishness. Because you are also in other people, and what helps them helps you. So I'm divinely selfish in wanting to talk to all of you and share with all of you. Because the more you gain from it, the more I gain. It's all, we're here to help each other to find why we're here at all. We're here for one purpose. God created this whole universe, dreamed it into existence, and the goal of life is to understand that this mystery is solved only when we turn back to Him. Is there Satan? Yes, there is Satan, but he's not an old man with the horns and the tail and so on. He's in your own heart. That's the trouble. I remember Norman, a brother disciple of mine, going through tests, and he said, if only I could see him and get them in my hands. He was a very strong person, but you can't fight it with muscle. You have to fight it with discrimination. It's like threading a needle. And so, yes, it's difficult, but that Satan is also a part of God's dream. This is the joke of it. I remember when I was writing a play, and I had fun writing the parts of villains. They were very villainous, and I showed them completely justified in their villainy from their point of view. It was great fun. I think God has fun with Satan, too. Because it's that aspect of God that creates, that sends things outward into creation. He had to have that force go outward for creation to become manifested. But everything is really only a manifestation of His consciousness. We are, as it were, on a fence here. And on one side, I'll say left, because left is this way for you, although that's right for me. So on one side is Satan, on the other side is God. If you turn toward Him, mind you, this is a very important point that Master said. In fact, if you read autobiography very carefully, you'll see that many, many sentences seemingly tossed out are filled with wisdom. One such sentence was that men's thoughts are universally, not individually directed. Our thoughts come from the level of consciousness on which we are living. I remember many years ago I fell into a mood. I was new on the path, and I tried to get out of the mood by reasoning my way out, and it didn't work. Reasoning kept showing me all the reasons why I deserve to be in the mood. I ought to be in the mood. I was right to think negatively, and so on. And I asked myself, but do I enjoy this mood? And I said, no, I don't enjoy this mood. So I said to my mind, well, boys, what do we do about it? Do you want to change? Yes, yes. So I went to my meditation room and I sat down and meditated. You know, it was all it took was five minutes. I brought my level of consciousness upward to this point. Suddenly I saw all the reasons why it was ridiculous to be in a mood, why everything was fine, I was just misunderstanding things. But every thought that you have, when you have a mood, feeling, reason follows feeling. Don't trust feeling, it's going to make you miserable. Suspend it, go to a higher level. But the level of consciousness you're on, it seems so real to people when they're on lower levels that that's their reality. And you can't persuade them differently. Reason isn't going to do it. And when they change their own level of consciousness, however, suddenly everything is different. So change your level of consciousness and do that which makes you happy. Evil, one thing about evil is it doesn't make you happy. Oh yes, it's like a mosquito bite when you scratch it. It hurts, but it feels pleasant at the same time, doesn't it? So evil does have a certain pleasantness, like scratching a mosquito bite. But it doesn't work. You find yourself becoming more and more miserable. When you lift your consciousness, suddenly you find everything changes because you're in a different plane of consciousness. And the thoughts that you have, this is how I've written all that, music and so on, I don't have to think about what I want to write, how I want to write it. All I do is ask my superconscious, ask God. I say, I want this song to say this, 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 and this. And suddenly it's there, just like that. You'll find that your answers will come very easily if you lift up your heart and mind and seek solutions. So anyway, there's so many things I would like to tell you, but I'm only here a short time. And so I was thinking, and I guess I'll have to stand up for this, but I was thinking that if you have any questions you would like to ask, I'd be very happy to try to answer them.